Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Hello, Tom here, just with one more brief disclaimer to add. In this episode, we talk about some of the books that John Cork worked on, but I think we failed to give his co-authors the credit they deserve. So when we talk about the book James Bond, The Legacy, it's worth noting that this book was co-authored by Bruce Sivily. Bruce also worked with John on the DVD extras that we talk about. And John told us that no one works harder or digs deeper than Bruce, saying he's one of my best friends and the best professional association I've ever had. We also talk about the James Bond Encyclopedia. We should note that John actually only co-authored the first edition of that book with Colin Stutz. And it's Colin that actually has done all the subsequent updates for later editions of that excellent Bond Bible. Finally, we mentioned the documentary and book Bond Girls Are Forever. And it's worth noting that these were co-authored by Mariam Diabo of the Living Daylights fame. Hello, you are listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast. As always, my name is Tom Butler and I'm joined by Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hello.
And Mr. Tom Wheatley.
Hello.
We are continuing our odyssey through the world of the James Bond films from A to Z. We are currently on the letter C and we will be joined in this episode by Mr. John Cork. This is the first time that someone we have covered in the podcast is appearing in the podcast. So very thrilled to be joining for him to be joining us for this. He, if anyone has watched any of the DVD extras on the James Bond films, you'll recognise John. He appears in many of them. He's also written, produced and directed more than 30 documentaries for the DVD and Blu-ray releases. He's also the author of a number of books that we refer to a fair bit, including the James Bond, The Legacy, James Bond Encyclopedia, Bond Girls Are Forever. He's written countless books about Bond, so we will talk to him about all of that. Before that, though, we've got a couple of corrections. Brendan, do you want to start with something that a statement?
I'd like to retract the first incident of Rain being Casino Royale in 2006. That was incorrect, as pointed out by who was it who pointed out on Twitter?
MI6 Confidential, the website/magazine. Yeah.
So thank you for correcting me. It was actually on Her Majesty's Secret Service. It was the first.
You've certainly been a bit sheepish for the past few weeks.
I've had to lie low about this,
yeah. We also, I can't remember why we were talking about Canada. Oh, we had a listener from Canada and said that Bond had never shot in Canada. We were swiftly corrected by Brian Valco on our Facebook page, who said that The Spy Who Loved Me did shoot in Canada. And we talked about this when we were doing, I don't know now, possibly Willy Bogner. They basically, part of the shoot, part of the jump off the mountain was filmed on Mount Asgard, which is in Canada. So I think we're still fair to say that it's never been set in Canada. So
unless somebody else corrects us.
Yeah, unless someone else corrects us. But that's the beauty of the podcast, right?
Yeah, we're always happy to be corrected.
Yeah.
And they're just the ones that people have messages about. There's probably a lot more.
Yeah, they probably just deleted the feed from their phones and said, never listen to these idiots again. But I mean, I guess as we explain on the intro, we are on a learning journey, the three of us. We're lifelong fans, but we are learning new stuff every episode. We set our homework for each other at the end of the episode, and we have about a week to read all the books and learn everything we can. So, yeah, sometimes we do get it wrong, and we love to hear from people who... can correct us. So please do that. Let's get on with speaking to John Cork. Welcome to the podcast, Mr. John Cork. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's nice to be here.
It's amazing, John, because you're the first person that we've spoken about on the podcast that we are getting to speak to. So it's a real honour for to be joined by yourself today. You've come up twice, once when we were talking about the Pierce Brosnan era of films, and then we talked about yourself specifically, because you've got quite an interesting connection to the Bond films, which is why we asked you on. But we just to start off, where does your love of James Bond come from? Where does that originate from?
You know, the first film I ever remember seeing in a movie theater is From Russia with Love. I was 3 years old. It was on a double bill with Dr. No, according to my mother. I have no memory of Dr. No, but the only memory I have of From Russia with Love is I'm watching the film and James Bond fires the very pistol, it ignites the fuel and the water on fire. And I knew at that age, water couldn't burn. And I turned to my mother and asked her, I'm sure at a volume that the entire theater, the Capri Movie Theater in Montgomery, Alabama, could hear, and asked how James Bond was making water burn. And my mother proceeded to explain to me that, he poured gasoline on it, and it's the gasoline that's burning. So, not that anybody needed that scene explained to them, but that's my memory. Friends had James Bond cars. I remember seeing some trailers for films. I saw Majesties in the theater. I saw Diamonds in the theater. But I really became a James Bond fan when I was 11 years old, and a friend of mine and I rode on a Friday afternoon in the summer up to that same Capri movie theater in Montgomery, Alabama. It's the first movie I ever rode my bicycle to go see. And we saw Live and Let Die. And the title song still gets me goose flesh every time I hear it. The action with the speedboats was beyond magnificent. I grew up around speedboats. My grandparents had a lake cabin, and so they had ski boats, you know, year or two before, my grandfather had gotten a Sidewinder, which was a very fast inboard-outboard speedboat. And I'm not sure what deal he had done somewhere to afford this monstrosity, but it had the sparkly fiberglass stuff. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. And so when the speedboat chase started, I thought, oh yeah, I know this world. And I didn't know this world. I had never seen speedboats jumping over roads, jumping over land, flying over cars, you know, crashing into things like this. And I remember thinking consciously in the theater, after that chase had ended, I've just seen the greatest 10 minutes of motion picture film that my 11-year-old mind had ever seen. And I was also on that cusp of puberty, so I had no idea how to talk to girls. I had no idea how anything possibly worked. And here was this guy who had this incredible confidence about him. He could be witty, he could be sophisticated. He certainly was not a country music listening, tobacco chewing redneck, which is kind of what I didn't want to be at that point. So, you know, there was a lot going on there that really appealed to me. And about a year later, I'd bought the soundtrack album. I'd listened to the song over and over. I had seen what little bit I could see. I kept asking people about James Bond movies and stuff. I think I may have gotten John Brosnan's James Bond in the cinema and read all the summaries of all the films, but I finally got around to starting to read the novels. My mother checked two of the novels out from the library for me, and by the time, and that was in early summer, and by the time I hit Christmas, I'd read all the novels twice.
That's fantastic. I think a lot of people get hooked in at that age, right?
Yes. I mean, James Bond certainly appeals to the adolescent boys in all of us. And that was, you know, noted in the literary review for Dr. No that Paul Johnson wrote. So in a very demeaning sort of way.
So how did that then lead up to your actual involvement like with the Bond films? So on that trajectory.
Well, it's a weird and complicated story, and I don't know how much you guys are going to be interested in it, but I'm going to prattle on for a little bit. You can edit out what you don't want. So in 1978, I'd gone over to the UK, to Europe, in fact, on one of these, if it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium type of trips that my grandfather had given me. And I loved it. I mean, it was this incredible world of just, you know, history and architecture, and it just felt so much cooler and more sophisticated than Montgomery, Alabama did. I'm not sure why, but it did. And when we got to London, which was in later July, the premiere of Spy Who Loved Me had been July the 7th, 1977, and I had actually gotten called internationally at great expense. My allowance was not happy when I had to pay that bill. But over to the Eon offices. I'm not sure how I found the number, but International Directory Assistance, something like that. And I had gotten a flyer to buy premiere tickets, which I still have in a file folder somewhere around here. But I couldn't be there for the premiere, of course, because we weren't going to be there in London at that time. And I went to see it. And that week that I went to see The Spy Who Loved Me, which I stayed for two screenings, that weekend, they opened up Pinewood Studios, supposedly for the first time in history, for tours. And so I got to go out there. I got to walk across the 007 stage, which was actually being built out for ice with ice blocks for something that I think is like two or three shots in Superman the movie. They had one of the Lotuses out there. They had Kurt Jurgens's chair back that went on the back of his sort of director's chair thing that he would sit on set. I bought that. It was amazing to me, somebody who was already very interested in film. So I came back from that and I thought, how do I get back over to this incredible world over here? So I found a program that was a semester program, got my school to agree to let me go, got my grandparents to agree to let me go, got my mother to agree to let me go. And while I was there, you had to do a special research project, which I did on the British film industry. And thus it gave me an excuse to just look at the production of Moonraker, which was the only thing I was actually really interested in. So, which was, of course, only the special effects were being shot in the UK. So everything else was in Paris. Nobody seemed to care. Did not knock my grade any. I met some people involved with the films at that point, and I asked one of the guys, this was a guy named Morris Thrift and Derek Coit, and I asked them if they said, you know, you've been a great kid, you're smart, you're energetic, we like you. Is there anything we can do for you? And I said, yeah, I'd love to go to the premiere of Moonraker in the US. And they said, well, we could get you in the premiere in the UK. But I didn't think I could get back. And then he suggested I write a certain letter to UA in the States. I did. And I got invited to the US premiere of Moonraker. And UA Publicity took my picture with Roger Moore, which I have sitting around here on the wall somewhere. So they truly made a lifelong fan out of me at that point. I went to film school at the University of Southern California. I remained a Bond fan, went to some of the early screenings, went to some other premieres. But in 1989, I wrote a script that was made into a film which opened in 1991 called The Long Walk Home with Sissy Spacek and Whoopi Goldberg. As far away from a Bond film as you could get. It's a civil rights drama about two women during the Montgomery bus boycott. But that got me kind of my foot in the door of the industry. And at a certain point, I was contacted by a guy I'd bought some books from named Mike Van Blaricum. When you get to the V's, Mike is a great guy to talk to. And Mike had gotten a call from somebody at Eon who said, hey, there's this submarine from For Your Eyes Only that is in the bowels of the Intrepid aircraft carrier, which is now a tourist attraction in New York, and they want to get rid of it, but they called and asked us if we wanted it back first, but a dive club wants it. They want to sink it into the bottom of a rock quarry in New York State, and then they'll go and do dives down to the thing, you know, just as something to see at the bottom of the rock quarry. And Doug Radinius, Mike Van Blarick, and myself decided, no, we have a much better idea for that submarine. We will buy it and restore it, and we will create this thing called the Ian Fleming Foundation, which is still existing. I'm not on the board anymore, but I still talk to all the guys who are involved. They do a lot of work, and less so with Ian Fleming than the James Bond vehicles, more than anything else. They've preserved a lot of the Bond vehicles. And they started asking me a lot of questions in the early 90s of like, what the hell's going on with Bond? How come there's not another Bond film? What's going on with the legal wrangling with Giancarlo Peretti and Credit Lyonnais and MGM? And, you know, is Bond dead? And so I called up my agent, incredible, wonderful woman at the United Talent Agency, and I said, what's going on with the Bond films? And she knew I was a huge Bond fan. And she called me back. She said, you know, they're just beginning to interview writers, and you have an appointment to go in and pitch.
Wow.
Don't blow it. So, and the, you know, I got this chance to go in to pitch. Barbara Broccoli, I think, was impressed with what I had to say about the character and the sophistication, the sexuality, and you know, how important that sex appeal was going to be to Bond. And so they brought me back in for a second meeting. Cubby Broccoli was there for that one. And I went off to the UK, where we were trying to start a archival project with Glidrose in the UK. And while I was there in that office, my agent called the Glidrose offices, because Glidrose holds the literary rights to the James Bond series. It's now Ian Fleming Publications, but at the time it was called Glidrose. Anyway, so she called the offices. She knew where I was and said, you got the gig. So I was literally standing in a room filled with boxes with all of Ian Fleming's professional papers surrounding me.
Wow.
When I got the call saying, you get to go in and try to write a treatment for a future Bond film. Now, she knew, and I knew at that time, that they had hired Michael France to write what would become GoldenEye. And then I was hired, on my checks, it said Bond 18. Now, here's the thing. Writing a James Bond script is an incredibly tough job. Particularly, you know, Michael Wilson is somebody who has a very, very high standard. I'm not great at writing treatments. It's not my thing. I like writing the dialogue and the specifics of the action and, you know, getting into the nitty-gritty, but treatments are not a lot of fun for me. So we went around. I must have gone through 30 stories, because my story involved a satellite. And Michael said very rightfully, you know, the last thing we're going to do is make a first film about a satellite, and then make Bond 18 also have something to do with satellites, which of course ends up what happening with Tomorrow Never Dies anyway. But so we kept trying to, you know, come up with different ideas and stuff like that. There were a lot of things I pitched over and over again. Tried to work a bunch of stuff out, but I got very frustrated early on. And when I say early on, it was at my second meeting after I was hired, where I said to them, okay, which iteration of James Bond is going to be the James Bond in, you know, that you want? Because the James Bond in Dr. No is actually even different than the James Bond in Goldfinger, much less the James Bond in The Spy Who Loved Me, or the James Bond in A View to a Kill, you know, and From There to License to Kill. The characters are very different. And this sort of went around in a little discussion. And at a certain point, I said, have you ever read the Bond novels in the order in which they were published and looked at the way Fleming develops the character and what Bond's journey is through the series, which is kind of an interesting journey for me? And Michael Wilson said, I've read the book so many times. And Barbara said, you know, I've never read them in order. And there was a development guy who has done a lot of screenwriting, great guy, who turned to me at that point and he said, can you get me a list of the Bond novels in order? And I said, yes. And I looked up at the ceiling and went, Casino Royale, Live and Let Die, Moonraker, Diamonds Forever. And I just listed them out in order. And then I looked back down and Barbara, Michael, and John Claflin were all looking at me like, holy shit. this guy, he may know a little bit about James Bond. Well, this ended up leading to me, another writer, Richard Smith, had tried to write some stuff up about who the character was. And John Claflin urged me to do my own version of that. And that ended up being something like a 90-page document that was called like James Bond in the 90s, which looked at Bond, looked at the role of women in the Bond films, looked at what makes a great villain, looked at what makes a great henchman, who Q should be, who Moneypenny should be. And that document actually became the thing I contributed at that point. That document was given around to future writers. It was given around to department heads, certain department heads or whatever, so that people had kind of a template to look at and say, oh, wow, here's all these things that Fleming wrote about who James Bond was. Here's all these things from the films that sort of reinforce or echo those things in different ways. Here's a list of things from the films in these different categories that may not work as well. Example, counterexamples of where things may have fallen a little bit flat. And that was a lot of different meetings. Cubby Broccoli got involved, Dana Broccoli got involved, and you know, a lot of back and forth on what should be in that document and what shouldn't be in that document. And that was really my contribution. I never wrote a treatment for them. I mean, we went round and round, and we could never kind of come up with a story that excited Michael and Barbara in the way that, you know, I kind of hoped it would. But the character Bible became a weirdly involved in the Sony lawsuit that came up just before Tomorrow Never Dies opened. And then weirdly, at the same time, I'm editing this fan publication called GoldenEye Magazine for the Ian Fleming Foundation, and trying to get people to rope them into doing newsletters so that people wouldn't riot over the fact that I couldn't get, you know, a magazine done once every couple of months. So it's like my hobby was James Bond, my work was James Bond. So it was a lot. On that,
a lot of questions off the back of everything you've just told us, but I think one of the main ones for me is you wrote this character Bible. When you watch the films now, do you ever see anything in them and think, oh, that's something I wrote back then? They're using that information I gave them.
Character Bibles don't quite work that way. You know, there's the broad generalization of who is this person, and then there's the very, very specific application that writers, directors, and actors go through and you know, interpret that. And so, you know, in the character Bible, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was in the initial draft because, you know, it was like, okay, what kind of shoes would James Bond wear? What kind of, you know, do we want to put him back in a Rolex? Do we want to do this? And I would list out kind of pros and cons arguments on these things. What kind of car is he going to drive these days? And of course, then you get, you know, BMW comes up and says, ho, have we got a deal for you? We've got this hot little roadster that we're going to be putting out. And all the arguments about whether it should be an Aston Martin or a Lotus or whatever, they just go completely out the window because somebody's come up with a car and you actually want that sort of newness, that sort of like the new hot thing that people can grab hold of. So I think it comes through in some of the attitude you see, particularly in GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies. I think after that, the usefulness of that initial document went away. They had me redraft it in 1999. I redrafted it, I believe. But they were already had shot The World Is Not Enough by that point. They were, you know, when Michael asked me to redo the document, I think they were already past that. And I didn't, you know, again, it just really comes down to like, you know, just sort of an attitude more than anything else.
Can you tell us a little bit more about working with Cubby and Barbara and Dana and Michael? Like, what are those people, what are they all like? Because we've talked about them a lot on the podcast, but we get a sense that, you know, they're very family orientated people and they hold James Bond very dearly to their chest. But like, how would you characterize them?
Well, you know, Michael Wilson, he summarizes himself, I think, in sort of a great way, is he's somebody who carries around a little card in his wallet that has the periodic table of elements on it. He is an incredibly practical person. He loves James Bond, but he's nothing like James Bond. You know, he wears tweed, not some, you know, exotic suit and everything like that. And he doesn't try to model his behavior on James Bond. And I think that's really wonderful because he comes at it with this engineer's point of view. And that's how you get the opening sequence in The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. He's the one who says, wait a second, hold on. Let's look at this incredible stunt thing, that incredible stunt thing. How, you know, can we work this into a story on that end? He's somebody who very much is interested in sort of engineering how you make a movie the most efficient way possible. And it's hard to think of the Bond films as being efficient, but, you know, they are an incredibly efficient machine on how they put those films together. Because the more efficient you are, the more money you get to keep in your pocket. I mean, that's the bottom line. So, you know, he loves the technicians. He shooting an interview with him once, and he was fascinated by the light kit we were using to light the interview, and was like, "Wow! So you know, tell me about these lights and stuff like that." So he's very, very practically minded. Barbara is just warm and generous in so many ways. She is the kind of person who, you know, if she knew the chips were down and she gave a flip about you, she goes to people's rescue. She cares about people a lot. And so you can see this in the script development when you get Barbara really involved, when you get to GoldenEye, that the characters become a little more complicated, a little more interesting, a little less of kind of the you know, there's a tendency in films to sort of go for the tropes, to go for characters that are a little bit more cliched. So that when they were making Dr. No, for example, you know, one of the things that Terrence Young and Lois Maxwell agreed was that Miss Moneypenny was not going to be wearing glasses with a pencil behind her ear and sort of the lovelorn secretary or whatever, that she had to be more interesting than that. And then by the time you get to The Living Daylights and they recast her, Miss Moneypenny becomes the glasses, the hair in the bun, the pencil behind the ear, the lovelorn secretary character. And these sorts of things, you know, creep in over time when you get familiarity and you're not pushing the characters as hard. Barbara pushes those characters. And she's been very involved with story creation as well. I mean, it was her idea to say, hey, these oil fields in Azerbaijan, they're fascinating, and you know, what if we were to make a story that surrounded how oil moves around in Europe and the world, and to try to use that as a core thing. And so she can get involved in the physics of the story as well, and if Michael's into it, boom, there you go, you're off to the races. But you know, you see with Barbara, she is pushing the writers to push those characters further.
And what was Cubby like to work with?
When I met Cubby, he was certainly older. He was so he was not, you know, as engaged on that end. He was not at all the meetings, but he was someone. It's really hard to express when you're somebody like me, and you walk into the room and there's Cubby there. And you're sitting down with him. And, you know, Cubby is also not like James Bond, and he doesn't try to be like James Bond. Cubby liked to wear blue jeans. Cubby wore belts that were big, thick leather belts with large Texas Western belt buckles on them. And, you know, he talked with this New York Italian accent that it sounded like Marlon Brando modeled the Godfather performance off of that accent. he lived in this incredible Beverly Hills mansion, which the whole time I was there, there was an American TV show called The Beverly Hillbillies. And the whole time I was there, I could only hear like the musical sting from The Beverly Hillbillies going through my head. And I was like, you know, we're sitting out on this little balcony, and there's a Filipino manservant who's serving us like brunch stuff while we're trying to talk about the character Bible, and there's the pool out there, and I kept wanting to say, you know, when was the last time somebody swam in the cement pond, which is what they called it during the Beverly Hillbilly show. So but he was he was incredibly warm. He was deeply in love with his wife Dana. He got a lot of joy out of filmmaking and a lot of joy out of creating something that could make an audience, you know, get involved. And he also had for somebody who was, you know, I think battled his weight his entire life and never looked like he was the fittest guy in the room, he loved adventure. I mean, this is a guy who had gone on a sailboat to Hawaii. He liked going on locations to places. He'd gone to the South Pole to shoot Hell Below Zero. He had gone to Africa to shoot, you know, Spain, the Bahamas, Jamaica. He loved, you know, going places and doing things and making the story feel real. So, that's kind of, the big thing I remember about him is that, you know, when that would shine through. I came into the office one time, I was just dropping something off, and Cubby was there. And, you know, the first time I met him, he said, "Call me Cubby." You know, everybody calls me Cubby, you know, so if you call me Mr. Broccoli, you know, it means you don't like me, you know, so sort of thing. But I came into the office, and he was just in fine form. Most of the time I'd come in and we might be eating lunch at the restaurant, or we'd be sitting in Michael's office, you know, which was also Cubby's office, but it was really Michael's office. And, you know, Cubby would be very quiet for like 90% of the meeting. You know, I'd be talking about, like, we could do this auction scene. You know, we did an auction scene, an octopus scene. It's like, yeah, and the reason that I felt like that scene didn't have, like, anything that got bigger and bigger, that's why I kind of wanted to propose this, like, other kind of auction scene. But, you know, it'd be something like that. I wouldn't say it that way to him, of course. But, you know, he would just come in with these little brief things to say. But Cubby was out in the lobby and everything like that. And Barbara's standing there with him. And somehow the story, something about a premiere comes up. And I'm not even sure which premiere it was. It may have been A View to a Kill, but I'm not really sure. And he said that he was at the premiere, and he's, of course, job is, as the producer, to go through and introduce Diana and Charles to everybody who's in the line. And he gets to somebody's wife. The director's wife, I think John Glenn's wife, I could be wrong on that. And he can't remember her name right then. And he's like so embarrassed and everything. And he said, you know, I was just so flustered. And, you know, she, of course, said her name, and he apologized. And then he turns, and Barbara's standing next to him, next to them. He says, and this is somebody's name, of course, I can't forget. It's my daughter. And he said, the mind dropped out. The bottom dropped out. He's looking at his daughter and he's like, oh my God, I can't remember her name. Barbara's standing next to him and she's laughing and rolling her eyes and everything. But, you know, he had no ego about telling somebody like me that story.
That's funny.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like a real human. That's somebody who is, you know, not one of these cocky assholes who thinks they rule the world or anything like that that you hear about in the film industry or anything. And, you know, this is somebody who just loves people.
You've talked a lot about the Bond series, but obviously you've got a lot of work that you've done on DVD extras and short documentaries. How did that come about? And I'm sure the other guys are as interested as me. And what is the process for that? Because we watch these extras on the DVDs and Blu-rays all the time. What is the process for pulling those together?
So the way that came about is, you know, I had been doing this work with Barbara and Michael and a guy named Lee Pfeiffer, who at the time really kind of dealt Bond memorabilia and had written a book with Phil Lisa that was, you know, sort of like a manna from heaven for Bond fans. And he had gotten very interested in the idea of doing something for Laserdisc, and he had some contact at MGM or whatever and stuff. And he, you know, when he met me, he was like, oh, this guy's got contacts with Eon and stuff, and you know, maybe he can make the help make this happen. He got another guy involved named Mark Cerulli, and so we went off to London with a Bond fan named Paul Scrabo and his wife George Ann, and we did special features for Goldfinger and Thunderball for these big, elaborate, multi-disc, laser disc versions of the film. And that was a lot of fun. I was the guy in the Los Angeles area. I was living in Burbank at the time. And so I kind of, you know, the closure work kind of fell to me on completing a lot of that stuff. There were some mechanical problems with working with MGM on getting the editing done. They were trying to do a type of editing that was going to be very complicated, made changes very difficult. So we ended up going to New York to finish those off. Lee and Mark during that time had some family obligations, so I kind of went and slept on a guy's floor in New York that I could do, because we didn't have any money. I mean, we just, you know, there were three of us, the pie is only so thick and everything like that. Lee had a full-time job, Mark had a full-time job. Mark's done some wonderful work over at HBO, and he's done some special features, I think, on Halloween and some other films that are really good. And We wrapped all of that stuff up. We got our editing done. MGM really liked the material. And then I moved on. Yeah, I was back in screenwriting. I was taking screenwriting assignments. I was not getting a lot made, but I was, it pays nice. So, you know, I'd kind of moved on. Occasionally some little Bond stuff would pop up. Lee and Mark and I tried to launch a couple of other projects, but Lee had his own sort of thing going on. I had my thing with the Ian Fleming Foundation going on, and we kind of moved off in different directions. During that time, actually right after we did Goldfinger and Thunderball, the laser disc for GoldenEye needed to be done, and the guy at MGM that I kept going in to see said, you know, do you want to produce this for us? And, you know, here's what it'll pay. And I was like, well, you know, let me contact. He said, no, the other guys, I don't ever see them. I don't know who they are. They're out there. I know how hard you've worked on these laser discs, so you come in and run the online sessions for us. So I did that and pulled together material for them and got some stuff cleared, coordinated the Michael Wilson, Martin Campbell audio commentary, got that recorded. And so some years passed, and it's 1999. I had written a spec script, which I was very, very excited about, and my agent was not excited about it. She didn't feel it had potential. And but during the time that I was finishing up that spec script, I got some phone calls from two different individuals, and they were like, hey, I think they're going to do some special features for the DVDs of the Bond films. Can I use you as a reference? And on both of them, I was like, yes, I'm happy to say that you're a good person and stuff like that. And then I get a phone call from a guy at MGM, and he says, hi, and, you know, MGM Home Entertainment. And he says, hello. And I said, so which of the people that I said I could use me as a reference are you calling about? He said, I'm not calling about either one of them. He said, everybody uses you as a reference. So we figure if everybody's using you as a reference, you're the guy we should call. And having just poured, you know, my blood, sweat, and tears into the spec script that my agent wasn't going to send out, was like, this could be interesting. And then my then wife was pregnant with my son, and it was like, you know, guaranteed work for a little bit over a year. I get to interview some of the people whose work I've admired since I was a kid. And that's how it came about.
Amazing. And did you work quite closely with, did did Barbara and Michael see the documentaries? Or were they involved in any way in them before they went onto the DVDs?
I called them up when the gig came up, and we had a phone call, you know, early on about stuff. And then when I came over to the UK, I sat down with Barbara and I interviewed both of them. I mean, a lot of the interviews for those DVDs were shot in Michael Wilson's office. So, you know, he'd be like, I can stay home. I can work from another place today. You guys shoot in the office. There's not enough room to light and everything. And, you know, he had that big partner's desk that Cubby and Harry had in there. On that. So, you know, it was enough room for us to bring people in and do stuff. Some days we shot down in the screening room they had, they have at the Eon offices. Some days we shot in the archival room, which tended to be the noisiest place. And then we shot at, you know, a lot of other locations. But yeah, I mean, they basically said, oh yeah, we're out to sell DVDs. That's great, because they get a cut of every one of those sales. So they love that.
Have you worked with all six of the Bond actors?
That's not really. I met and had dinner with Sean Connery one time, but he never gave us an interview for anything. And we never had to like go to him for clearance for anything, for that matter. When we were doing Goldfinger and Thunderball, when Mark Cerulli and Lee Pfeiffer and I were, Mark Cerulli's the one who had the contact at Connery's agency and supposedly got it pitched to him in a meeting, in a sit-down meeting at the agency. But we never were able to get anywhere. We had a great opportunity, a fantastic opportunity. He was going to do the voice for the From Russia with Love game, the last Sean Connery James Bond performance. So I knew this, and I go into the home entertainment offices because we're redoing the DVDs, and we had already, I believe, done the Roger Moore audio commentaries in Monaco, which had been a little bit of an operation and was wonderful to spend that time with him. And I went to a person there and I said, hey, you guys are about to pay, you're still in negotiations, but you guys are negotiating a $10 million contract with Sean Connery for this. You just need to call up the guys at MGM Interactive and you need to say, we want audio commentaries to be part of that deal. And I'll go to the Bahamas. I know all the behind the scenes stories. If they say Connery doesn't know, you've got a guy who can prompt him on everything. I have, at the time, I had all the call sheets. I had all the scripts. And that's how you really try to get a good audio commentary, is you have to be there on the guy's headsets, and you need to be prompting them to tell the story so they don't just start narrating the film. So, well, in this scene, I walk in and you know, I think
we've
I
all heard those ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, filmmaking for the blind. So it was a missed opportunity, because I think they could have gotten Connery at that point. $10 million is enough to say, you're going to sit down and you're going to watch these films again. And there's going to be a microphone in front of you. And so the way I worked it with Roger Moore, for example, is I would talk to Roger a little before the film started. Then we would start the film. I would prompt him throughout. If he said something, you know, legal gets in there and other people look at it and they're like, I don't like him saying this or whatever. So you get little blips cut out all over the place, or he's factually wrong on this and we might take it out because he'd said something wrong. But then at the end, I would ask him all these other things throughout. So if there was a long scene that he wasn't in, I might ask him something about his background or something. But then afterwards, I would ask him things. If there were things that weren't clear in what he said, which Roger Moore was incredibly articulate, but if there were things that I thought he kind of bumbled over or didn't say very clearly, or I thought might be confusing, I would ask him to tell that story again. And then we'd take all that audio and then we'd try to block it out to do the film. But yeah, I mean, I worked with Roger. I certainly interviewed George Lazenby. I never interviewed Timothy Dalton. I met him a few times socially at occasions, but I never interviewed him. Interviewed Pierce Brosnan and met him on a couple of occasions. And then when we were doing the Casino Royale Collector's Edition, I was on the set of Casino Royale in Prague. They were shooting the casino scene. So Daniel's in the tux. He's looking like $1 million. He is Bond there. And so I got to meet with him and, you know, chat very briefly with him. But we never interviewed him for that. We tried to set it up, but frankly, we didn't really need a new interview with him for the material that we were doing. There was so much stuff that was done by this company called Special Treats, which does amazing and excellent work. I mean, I kept wondering, why the hell are they hiring us? They've got Special Treats already there, you know, to do all this stuff. But they did, and we were very grateful for that. But, you know, I wanted to concentrate on stuff that there's no way a company like Special Treats that was on the set was going to be able to focus on for that edition. So we did a lot of stuff about the original novel, Ian Fleming, the character of James Bond, Bond's history with the Bahamas, you know, that kind of stuff.
That is a great one, the Bond's history in Bahamas, because it's so detailed. And when you watch that, and it shows you where they shot that thing in Casino Royale and how close it was to where they were filming, you know, The Spy Who Loved Me. I thought that was a fascinating, such a great treat on that disc.
And Thunderball.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, hotel. You know,
it's like that half-finished building was built after Thunderball. They shoot from the roof for The Spy Who Loved Me from that unfinished structure. They shoot the free-running sequence for Casino Royale in there, but the Coral Harbor Hotel right behind it there, which is, it's all part of a military base now, a military installation. I don't know how much of a base it is or whatever, but there's the hotel lobby. You go through it, and then out there is a drained swimming pool. I don't know what it is now, but it was like, holy crap, you know, when you're looking at it. Because I'd always wondered, because, you know, they walk up the sea on Paradise Beach in the Bahamas, and they walk up there, and then they do this cut. It looks like there isn't a cut at all, hardly. I mean, it's one of these sort of Peter Hunt specials that just sort of like flashes past you. And they're walking up by the pool, but there's a channel behind it where boats are coming out. And you're like, where the hell was that channel? Because it certainly doesn't cut through that long stretch of beach that was in the background of the previous shot. And it's like, oh, they're in completely different islands. And total, you know, however many miles apart they are, but they just match that just brilliantly.
Amazing.
John, it's been 30 years since you did the character Bible in the 90s. Now it's the 2020s. Is it time to update it? And what do you think would be in that character Bible?
Well, the character Bible gets updated every time they make a film.
Right.
Not physically updated. I'm not sure anybody's sitting around doing that. I have actually communicated to Barbara and Michael in the past that you should get somebody to do it who maybe is involved with the films now on that. I feel like, you know, the Daniel Craig films have gone off kind of in their own direction with the character in a really fascinating way. Aside from Casino Royale, I haven't been involved with any of the special features on any of the films. It was time to pass the torch, particularly since the entire home entertainment market was dying in that sense anyway. And what you really get now is, you know, these very limited edition releases, and then you just get streaming service releases. I feel like they have, you know, they're about to come up with a brand new opportunity. I mean, hopefully there's already work going on whatever the next script is going to be and what direction they're going to take the character when they recast after Daniel Craig is going to be fascinating. So, but with Daniel Craig, I think they walked into a particular place where they decided after the success of Casino Royale to really hang on to this thing, which I had talked about in the character Bible, was you know, what is James Bond's burden? What is the thing that he carries with him? And I'd say, well, it's Vesper's death. And, you know, that this is, you know, there's the death of his parents, but there's Vesper's death. And, you know, Vesper's death is mentioned a couple of times more in the novels, but only very briefly, only in passing. And what they've done with the films is they've let that sort of sink its teeth in just a little bit more firmly, so that Quantum of Solace seems fixated on Vesper's death to a certain degree, and then it shows up again Skyfall. It shows up again in Spectre. On that end, you know, that there's this sort of like attempt to link everything together. And Michael, when I was working for them, he had said, you know, what do you think about the idea of doing a film that's a Bond film that's sort of told over, you know, a story, a larger story that's over like three films and stuff. And at the time I was like, I kind of like the idea that you can mix and match Bond films. It doesn't matter which one you see first. You can always understand everything that's happening in them.
Yeah.
You can see the series out of order and you're fine. And clearly, if you look at the success of the Marvel Universe or the Harry Potter films, Michael might have had a really interesting point. You know, whether that actually works for James Bond or not, I don't know. You know, I wonder how many people who walked in and saw Spectre and had seen all the previous films were like, oh yeah, I remember Mr. White. I'm really interested in what his fate is. But you know, I'm so caught up in the series, it's very hard for me to step back from that and know whether that's a general concern for a viewer or not, or whether they care, whether they remember Mr. White or not.
So where would you like to see it go next? Would you like the standalones to make a return?
You know, it's I just want them to be entertaining and frequent.
Yeah.
So
yes, yes.
And you know, I just, you know, it's like if somebody said, John, you know, we're gonna sit down, you're gonna be under contract, and you know, you're gonna be like a monkey at a typewriter, you're just gonna throw out Bond ideas all day long. I've done that job. It's actually not as fun of a job as you think it might be, but it's, you know, it's a lot of work, and you know, people aren't sitting around and patting you on the back and saying, good job. Oh, we love your talent. These are people who work with the most talented folks in the world. So, you know, if they feel you haven't hit the mark, they can be warm and nice and everything like that. But, you know, your self-esteem is not emboldened by the lack of joy and love you're going to be getting back from it there. So, but if somebody paid me to do that, that's one thing. But as it is now, I am now just a guy who walks into the cinema and watches the movies and, you know, will do like every other Bond fan and bitch about the stuff you think they got wrong and glory over the stuff that thrilled you to no end. And like every hardcore Bond fan, you know, you see a new Bond film and there's always this part of you that's like, gosh, it didn't ignite that same exact thing that a Bond film ignited in me when I was 11 years old. And that's just being older, so.
The question we've got here is that, which you've kind of answered slightly there, is obviously you've spent a lot of your life researching Bond, learning about Bond, delving into the various aspects of it. Do you still spend a lot of time looking in depth into the world of Bond?
I spend an inordinate amount of time with James Bond. I am standing in a room here where I have yards and yards of bookshelves filled with James Bond books and publications. My walls are covered with old 1960s James Bond related albums in frames, James Bond movie posters. When I went to Greece with my son in 2019. We did have to go scuba diving in the Ionian Sea. We did have to go mountain climbing at Meteora. You know, if I'm going to some place where there's a James Bond film location, I've got to be there. You know, those types of things bring me great joy. Just before I was doing this interview, I was trying to check something in a documentary I'd done for somebody who'd sent me an email about it. James Bond still brings me tremendous amount of joy, and that's the novels, that's the films, that's the music. You know, I bought a new car, a Mazda Miata, not quite willing to spend as much as a Aston Martin would run me. But, you know, I had to buy a license plate frame holder, which is in the United States. I don't know if they have these in England or not, but you know, you'll get these like little things that you put over the outside edge of your license plate frame. And so I decided I was going to order a specialty one. What does mine say at the bottom? Universal Exports Limited. What does it say at the top? Orbis Non Sufficit. So the world is not enough in Latin. I am still that wall-eyed James Bond fan geek. I am still always looking for these fascinating little connections. You know, there's an episode of Grey's Anatomy I have to now see because somebody, dying person has to put 007 in somebody's hand to let them know who he is because his face has apparently been ripped off or destroyed absurdly during the course of the episode. And, you know, somebody just told me about that. I'm always just like, oh, wow, you know, look at this. So I watch a film and I, you know, everybody who knows me knows that I'll do this. The credits will be going up and I'll be like, oh yeah, that person right there, they did costumes on Goldfinger. Or that person right there, they were script supervisor on all of these Bond films. I mean, this is the world I live in right now. And, you know, I could rebel against it or I could embrace it. Now, I have a lot of other interests, a lot of other things I enjoy doing. James Bond is no longer the way I make my living, which probably makes it easier for me to enjoy the world of Bond now. But yeah, that's you know, I was a fan and then I turned pro.
Just, well, we won't keep you for much longer, John, but a couple of your books we really rely on heavily for our podcast. We do, you know, we're going through the James Bond, the people who made James Bond in an A to Z way. One of our favourites is The Legacy. And is there a plan to ever update that book, you know, for the 60th anniversary or...
You know, you guys are more than welcome to contact Eon Productions because, you know, that book, it only came out in this large format hardback.
Yeah.
And I mean, I had the executive at MGM who was working with Barbara and Michael come to me and he was like, you know, can you talk them into doing this into like just a text version of the book so that it's easier to read? Because it's like, you know, I try to read it in my desk or a bed and it's this huge, unwieldy thing. I had people come to me and say there should be an audiobook version of this or whatever, and I would love that, you know, a little ebook version of it. That would be fantastic. Are they going to do it? The odds are very, very low. You know, it's just like the odds of them calling me up and saying we'd like to get a Inside Tomorrow Never Dies documentary, John, which is another thing that people will say. You know, there are only a few titles that don't have that, you know, specific type of making of documentary on them. And I'm like, yeah, well, probably going to stay that way, at least for the foreseeable future. But I'm very proud of that book. You know, it was a lot of fun to work on. Bruce Sively, my co-author, certainly deserves every bit of the 50% of the credit, you know, on that end. We work together very well as a team, and Bruce is an amazing base of knowledge on Bond stuff and somebody who just, you're rarely going to find somebody who works harder than Bruce.
So one final question then, John. You've spoken about your collection there. There's a fire in your house. What's the first bit of James Bond memorabilia that you pick up?
You know, that's really, really tough. You know, the instinct would be go and get the first editions. And I don't have all the British first editions, and a lot of the ones I do have aren't with dust jackets. I do have all the American editions in dust jackets now, so I'm happy about that. But, you know, it changes week to week. You know, I don't spend a lot of time just sort of like luxuriating over the collection. There's a lot of organizing I need to do with it. I donated a huge, huge amount to the University of Southern California Special Collections Library. So that wasn't like... some of the book stuff, but not a ton of it. But I didn't have room for it anymore. And, you know, I talked to the lawyer over at Eon, and he was like, yeah, they're a great repository for it. So, you know, now anybody who wants to see the call sheets from those early films, they're there. They can be researched. So, yeah, it's a very tough question. I would love to say I had a great answer for you there, but be honest with you, this is all on the third floor of where I live. And if there's a fire, I'm unlikely to be on the third floor, and I'm not going to be running up. I'm going to be running out.
Fair enough. Thank you so much, John. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. It's been really enlightening for us. And yeah, wish you all the best, and hopefully we'll get to see No Time to Die soon. And we'd love to hear what you thought of it when that happens.
Sounds good. And if I can be of assistance with any of your other podcasts in talking about the films or the people, I was sorry I couldn't talk about Casino Royale 67.
I'm sure we'll take you up on that one, John. There's lots of information that we always want to know, and you're probably the person who knows the answers to it.
I'm one of the people. There are plenty of people who know. I could give you whole lists of names. When you get to GoldenEye, Matthew Parker, things like that, people you need to talk to. So anyway, take care. Great talking to you guys.
Thank you, John.
You too. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, John Cook, for joining us for this special episode of the podcast. His book, as mentioned, James Bond, The Legacy, is available. It's a massive book, as he said. You two have both got it, right?
Get an extra bedroom to store it.
It is a heavyweight tome, but well worth a read. And also he worked on the encyclopedia as well. Also worth looking at, and loads of other books. But thank you so much, John, for joining us. How did you find it, guys?
Absolutely fantastic.
I need a few days to digest all that information.
Mm. Yeah, I'm still just sat here, sort of, just in a daze.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's not often you get to speak to somebody who has personal interactions with all these characters that we're talking about every week. So it's a pretty amazing opportunity to find out about them.
Yeah, and it shows that, you know, spending all this time looking into James Bond can pay off for some people. So validation. We will be back again soon with another episode of the James Bond A to Z. But if people want to contact us, how should they get hold of us?
Well, if you want to correct me on any more mistakes I've made, you can contact us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at James Bond A to Z.
And if you want to complain about any of Brendan's mistakes on email, that's podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Yeah, all your meteorological complaints can be directed. Director Brendan also on Twitter. You can find him on there as well. But thank you for listening. James Bond A to Z will return next time.
Thanks a lot.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.